This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress, from the studios of the Library of Congress. I am Grace Cavalieri. Patrick Bringley is here, and he's the 18th recipient of the National Book Award for Writing in the Arts, given from the DC Arts Club. And he's going to be here to tell us all about it, what it feels like to win this award, and where he's been and where he's going. Patrick, congratulations.
Oh, thank you very much. I'm so honored, and I'm so honored to be here talking
this
to you.
This is really a great honor because it's equal to the Pulitzer for writing in the arts. And what I like about it is it's about literature. This award is a book of literature, not just a book. And so your writing is being honored. And I know you're going to tell us he wrote poetry as a child. We'll get to that. So what's the title of the book?
All the Beauty in the World.
What's it about?
So I worked for 10 years as a guard at the Met, the big art museum in New York. So it's about that place. It's about the collections, about, you know, art from all over the world. It's also about the people inside there. 2,000 people work there and 500 guards. And they also are representative of the world in their own way. And then it's also a personal story. I came to the Met. I lost my brother. I didn't kind of want to go back to just some job where I'm rushing about and sort of in the normal rhythms of life. And I found this job where I was able to just stand still for a living.
But you had a sexy job at the New Yorker. You're already a writer. What was that job like?
So I was not writing for them. I was in the events planning office. They do something called the New Yorker Festival.
Oh, right, right.
So we were just a small office that put that together. So in some ways, it was very glamorous.
Yes.
And in some ways, it was heaps of fun.
Yeah. But you were with the suits. I mean, you were really where everybody likes to be on the 18th floor, you know, with all the writing people.
Yes.
So what triggered the fact that you wanted to go from all this glamour, actually, which it looks from a distance, it looks like glamour, to a solitary place standing in a museum? What was your fantasy?
Yeah, I mean, while I was at the New Yorker, of course, I had ambitions to sort of climb the ladder there and try to write, you know, little unsigned book reviews and then try to write talk of the town pieces and do things like that. But I found that, unsurprisingly, I wasn't any good at it because I was young and I was just out of college and I didn't really have anything to say particularly. I hadn't kind of original thoughts. So it just sort of occurred to me at some point that I just have a desk job. I mean, I'm just staring into a computer, answering email. And it was deflating in a sense because in one sense I felt like, oh my God, here I am at the pinnacle. I'm at 42nd Street and Broadway. And you know, clearly I've made it. But that's a silly thing to think when you're that young. And then what happened is my brother got sick and I'm spending all this time in hospital rooms and in his apartment in Queens. And he was just a very brilliant. He's a mathematician, but also just kind of very modest, straightforward guy. He handled his illness with just incredible grace. And it just was so, you know, being inside those rooms, they felt like these sacred spaces.
So you went from a feeling to the idea of a place for the feeling. I mean, but why that place? Why the Metropolitan Museum of Art? I mean, clearly you wanted to be like a monk or in some sort of solitude, although we find as we read the book, it's a pretty busy place. But why did you choose that place?
I mean, I think that I wanted to do something that felt nourishing and straightforward and honest and didn't have a bunch of, you know, office politics and corporate ladder climbing and sort of, you know, glitz and glamour and pizzazz because I was so, I don't know.
Humbled.
Yes,
humbled.
I was humbled.
Yeah.
I just felt like what I had witnessed in those hospital rooms was something real, something painful, but also something beautiful. And I kind of wanted to be in a place where I was just focused on those things,
that
on
were
life
true.
And death and suffering. And And I knew I always loved art, and I loved the Met, and I knew it as a beautiful place that's full of these things that are, you know, about something that's much bigger than ourselves. And I just, this, the idea of a job where I could just stand and watch and think my thoughts.
But it was the search for what was really true. What struck me, and I have read this book twice, what struck me was your personal odyssey from grief to the search for something so pure and so unsullied that it could make you believe in life, really. And I get that through the book. And you are reverent in every page, it's very devotional, and you go to art as a salvation, which is why I think this book is a winner, not because of the ease of reading, but because of what your search is about. It was really a spiritual journey, wasn't it?
Thank you. Yeah. Thank you very much. Yeah. I mean, it's funny because it's not like you don't necessarily go into things so intentionally. You know, some people ask me, you know, did you sort of go into this as sort of therapy for yourself? And it's like, well, you know, I guess sort of yes, sort of no.
Yeah, but you went somewhere for a reason, for sure. Yeah. And so I'm curious about how you recorded all of this like 300 pages of stuff. I mean, you didn't take notes. You couldn't take notes while you were standing there, could you? Did you try to memorize it and then go home and jot down what you'd seen?
Yeah, a little both. I mean, you could sneak a note here and there. But mostly what I always have a notebook in my pocket. I have for years. And I would write things
down.
Can
a guard stand there and write a note?
Yeah, I mean, you know, you can't stand there and write a book. I certainly didn't do that. But you could jot down a note. And then mostly you are on your breaks. You know, I would get breaks and I would write. I would write on the train home. I would just fill up these little notebooks because, you know, it occurred to me. And it wasn't because I was trying to write a book. I wasn't, you know, not till the last couple of years. But it just occurred to me that it's hard to write about art because art is very silent and it is speechless and it is concrete and it's not like words. And I just was interested, what thoughts can I think? I've got years and hours and hours and hours to think about this stuff. And I wanted to do something that was different than what a curator might do or a scholar might do, because they're writing sort of about, you know, schools and styles, and they're writing about how Goya set up his studio or something. But what could I write that's about the experience of looking at Goya?
It was, let's talk about looking, because that is what I got. How to see something. When I have students, I'll have them look at a tree for 20 minutes. They don't like it, but the first 5 minutes they see the tree, right? By the end of that, they have seen the bug on the vein of the leaf. So that's what this book shows us, how you looked at things. Talk about how you looked at things.
Yes. I mean, it has a component of time, for sure.
You went to the same exhibit over and over many times.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, because your brain simplifies things that it looks at, because, you know, we're a species that we're going around and we're looking for the relevant information, and we sort of see something and we pick out the relevant information, then we go on and we, you know, sort of go on about our lives. But if you're looking at an old master painting or something, that first simplification of it is just a tiny little blip of what the totality of it is, because this is something that's been made by human hands. Every single stroke has some sort of intention behind it. This is made out of ground up pigments of vegetable matter and insects and stones that are mixed with linseed oil and applied with layer after layer of semi-transparent glazes, and it creates this thing that has this depth to it. And that's just in terms of its, you know, material being also.
Alchemy, though.
This might be also a picture that of, you know, of the Passion of Christ or something.
Where
so it has dimensions that way, too.
Tell us about the drawings.
Yeah, so
the sketches, are they from you?
No. So they're by a very talented artist, Maya McMahon, who was an art student. Now she's working. She actually draws dragons for a television show for the WB and develops characters, which is a cool job. But yes, we wanted something rather than have reproductions in the book, which are sort of very literal and often underwhelming. You know, say there's a passage and I'm talking about the beauty of a Titian painting, and they turn the page and they see this reproduction, they might say, oh, well, it's not so hot. So Our idea, my idea, was that I wanted to have sketches that were evocative, that felt subjective, just like the prose is subjective, and would give a feeling of the picture without being a literal representation of the picture. And much like the sketches that you see in art museums, people, you know, sitting in front of a Titian and sketching it.
What a good idea. What a good idea. Well, you are the winner of the Arts Club of Washington 18th National Book Award for Writing in the Arts. It's called the Marfield Award. And I want everyone to know this is a big deal. It is a big deal because you're competing against all of the books in the arts. You know, the photography, painting, dance, everything, film. And this was chosen by you, All the Beauty in the World. So let's shift gears and talk about being a winner. Gosh, what is your life like since you won? Talk about your tours and radio interviews and your audiobook and just all the goodies that come with a prize.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, you know, it's funny because I spent all this time being quiet for a living, and now I just yap professionally.
The ebb and the flow.
Yes, but it's wonderful. I mean, I've gotten to travel to many places, many museums in particular. I'm very fortunate as an author because, you know, usually if you write a book, where are you going to talk? You're going to talk at a library. You're going to talk at a Barnes & Noble maybe. But those things don't fly you out and they don't pay you and things. So I'm very fortunate that I have this natural place to be speaking at museums. And I have a very natural audience because many of these museums have docents and they have members and they have communities that just love that place, that see that place as a kind of shining temple, you know, or it's a place that they have ties to. So they feel about that place similar to how they feel about the Met.
But what can you say? You have this whole book. How do you extrapolate the a small portion of it so that it's a discrete talk? How do you fold that?
So I often give a talk that is about the relationship of a great collection and a solitary individual. I mean, be that a guard or you or me or anyone who sort of wanders into a place like the National Gallery here in Washington and thinks, well, how do I relate to this? I'm just little old me. You know, how do I attack this collection? How do I make this connect with my life? Is that arrogant of me or should I be humbled? In fact, the title that I often give it is Great Museums and You and Me on a Humbling, Inspiring Relationship. And I sort of insist on both of these adjectives because I think that on the one hand, a museum like the Met humbles you, makes you feel tiny in sort of a pleasant way, insignificant, the way you are looking up at the nighttime stars and you think, you know, the little thoughts in my head, the little worries that I have, they're as nothing compared to this old world and its incredible diversity and marvel and splendor. But on the other hand, I think you can also sort of flip a switch and say, well, you know, a museum is an ode to you and me. It's about human beings. It's about the capacities of human beings, what they have in their heart and their head and what they can do with their hands. And that by extension, that's what we can do with our hearts and heads and with our hands.
You know, we're hearing this lyricism as you talk, and the book is a lyrical work of art. But there you were in a uniform with your feet that hurt. And you stood there day after day. How did you do that? I mean, day after day, you stood there in a room without moving. What does that take? I mean, that kind of stamina, and there had to be moments of boredom. There had to be moments of flight. What does it take to be a pillar?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you know, it takes...
Do you sometimes meditate out of your body or...
Yeah, you know, it's funny. You do all sorts of things because you have time enough in a day, you know? So sometimes you're just thinking about how your feet hurt and you're thinking about, oh my God, they put me in section K1, that's the Greek and Roman, and that's got marble floors and, you know, it's no good standing on marble compared to standing on wood. And, you know, I don't like this section chief so much. He's kind of a hard ass, and, you know, sometimes you're just thinking things like that. But the
10 hours at a time or 8 hours, what are your shifts?
So I did a schedule for most of my time where I did 12 hours Friday, 12 hours Saturday, 8 hours Sunday, 8 hours Tuesday. So 40 hours, but two 12-hour shifts, two 8-hour shifts.
I could never sit still for 12 minutes.
Okay, yeah, that you're standing.
You are a god among men just for standing you,
I
for
mean,
12
you
hours.
You learn.
Do you change time?
Yeah, so you know, you're not in one place. You are walking between. You usually have 3 galleries or so, and then you are on a team, so you're shifting between 3 posts over the course of the day. You're on one post, and then you're off on break for a half hour. Then you do the whole thing again. But you just have a very different relationship
to
time.
Yes, that is it. That is it. That is the kind of the magical part of this, that you possess time in a way that you never did before.
Yes. I mean, you said you couldn't stand still for 12 minutes. In an odd way, I think you would find it easier to stand still for 12 hours than for 12 minutes or to sit still, because you just make peace with the fact that you're not going to kill this time, you know?
There you
and
got it.
And there's a freedom in it. Because there's a freedom in it. You don't have your phone. You don't have anything to do. There's no to-do list. You're not thinking about like, oh my God, I'm at the line at the post office and look at this line and I got to get back to something. You've shown up to work and you've put your stuff in your locker and you are not permitted to get anything done. I got nothing done for 10 years.
But I'll tell you something. You have said the golden words. You made peace with it.
Yeah.
Maybe anything we make peace with, we can do.
Yeah.
Please read us a little bit of your book.
Oh, sure. Yeah, I think...
Patrick Bringley.
Yeah. So what passage do we have here?
What page?
I have a passage. It begins on page 31.
Okay.
To set it up...
You may borrow my book, but you may not have it.
Oh, sure. To set it up... So this is when I was kind of deciding... to be a guard. I was thinking about, I was at the Philadelphia Museum of Art, actually, not the Met, with my mother. My mom had, we recently had lost my brother, her son, and we went to, my mom's from Philly, and we went to the Philadelphia Museum of Art, and I wanted to read a portion where she and I are sort of walking through the museum, kind of shell-shocked, kind of soundless, you know, sort of speechless, in much the way that I was when I first arrived at the Met. And we split up, and I go and look at a painting of the Adoration, you know, of the child Christ with kings who have come to see him. And she looks at a painting of the Lamentation, and I think of Pietà, the dead Christ. And I think that these two pictures have oddly intermingling emotions that come to be an important part of my journey at the Met. That Adoration and Lamentation is sort of two sides of a coin. And I want to read a passage where I'm sort of dwelling on that. So I say, a scene of this type is called an adoration, and I held the rather beautiful word in my mind. How useful a name for a kind of tender worship that arises in such a moment. We are silenced by such a vision, softened, made penetrable by what is vibrant and unhidden but felt only weakly amid the clamor of everyday life. We need no explanation for our adored object. Adding context could only obscure its plain and somehow unmysterious mystery. No doubt you have felt this way about a sleeping child or lover, or maybe about the rising sun or the pounding surf, or maybe about a holy relic or a sweetly painted picture by a long-dead Italian. Watching my big brother squeeze hands and bravely endure, I had felt hardly anything else. There's a special clarity of light that seems to fall from a star of wonder, the same clarity seen in old master paintings. I left the picture and went looking for Maureen, my mom, in the early Renaissance galleries. When I spotted her, she was framed by a work more brutal and beautiful and even more truthful than the one I had found. It was painted by a master called Niccolò di Pietro Gerini, a Florentine working in the 14th century. Against a featureless gold background, it depicted a young man who was very beautiful, but bluntly dead, supported bodily by his mother who hugged her son as she would if he were living, a scene that is called a lamentation or pietà. My mother has always been a good one to cry, at weddings, at the movies, but this was different. She cupped her face, and her shoulders shook, and when I met her eyes, I saw she wept because her heart was full as well as breaking, because this picture inspired love in her, bringing both solace and pain. When we adore, we apprehend beauty. When we lament, we see the wisdom of the ancient adage, life is suffering. A great painting can look like a slab of sheer bedrock, a piece of reality too stark and direct and poignant for words.
That's why the book is great, When We Adore and When We Lament, because you put your own gloss on it from your own heart, really. It is not an objective book at all.
Yeah.
What did you learn about yourself? I mean, you tell a lot in the book, but now in retrospect, what did you learn about yourself that you never could have imagined?
Interesting. I mean, you learn how your mind works because you're sort of quiet enough and have long enough time to sort of track the thoughts that are popping into your brain, I guess like you might during meditation, and then sort of stretch them. I mean, I guess I wouldn't have thought I could think along the sort of wavelengths that I taught myself to think. These sort of long wavelengths, I learned to kind of write sentences and then write paragraphs kind of in my head. I learned to just, I don't know, be quiet and sort of look at not just the art, but the people passing through with a kind of interest that you were noticing things that kind of fell in between the cracks of what you might have names for.
I like that.
And I don't know. I guess I learned that about myself.
How about people? What did you learn about people that you couldn't have imagined? Because there are some good anecdotes in the book.
Yeah.
But just generally, what are they? Are people good or bad?
People are good.
I mean, basically good?
Yeah. The people who arrive at the Met, I mean, obviously there's darkness in people, but the type of person that brings, when people bring themselves to the Met, they're usually there to have a good time, to have an interesting time. You know, they're there with their eyes open, and sometimes they're there with their minds just wide open.
And sometimes the kids are there for the hot dogs afterwards.
Of course, and they're there to laugh at the, you know, penises and the statues and the naked ladies in the paintings, and they're there to, you know, gawk at the freak show of the mummies. And sometimes those kids actually, I mean, I would think they're more right than wrong about some of these things. Like, for instance, you know, the kids, they look at the naked ladies in the pictures and they're scandalized by them. And then a, you know, adult tells them, oh, well, this is art. You know, this is art. So therefore, you know, this is, you know, just an educational thing. And I'm thinking to myself, well, that's an erotic picture. It's clearly an erotic picture. There is some scandal. I mean, the sex is, that's real, that they're looking at. But to return to your question, I mean, I think I always liked the people, and I guess I was surprised by the types of people, and they're somewhat rare, but you get enough of them, who come into the Met and they see me and they ask, they often are alone, and I'm wearing a suit, but, you know, kind of a cheap suit, so I look approachable to anybody, and they're like, you know, so the Middle Ages, like, you know, what was that? And you think, oh God, well, that's a big old question. And you begin talking about this. You say, okay, well,
but not every guard knows these things.
No, of course not. But plenty do. And you then begin to have a conversation about just a huge subject, a huge sort of narrative of the world. And you begin to think, this museum has all these narratives, all these stories that none of us have our minds wrapped around. You know, no, we don't know the history of ancient China or Mesopotamia. I don't care if you're the director of the Met. You don't know more than a fraction of what's in that place and the stories of in that place.
As I look at you, I'm thinking, what is this five-year-old Patrick like?
Oh, five-year-old?
What was this five-year-old Patrick Bringley like? I'm looking at you and just seeing the five-year-old child and wondering, was he this way? Was he looking under rocks? Was he a miracle child? Was he looking at the wonders of the worms?
It is funny. Yeah. So my brother was 2 years older, and he was brilliant at math, and he was a brilliant student. So I think as a result, I viewed myself as kind of the artsy kid, you know, kind of the not quite straight ahead kid. My mom was a theater actor and in Chicago. And when I was 8 years old, she played Emily Dickinson in The Belle of Amherst, a one-woman show. And at that point, I decided— About Emily Dickinson. And at that point, I decided, I'm a poet. You know, I'm a poet. Actually, I think at one point I showed up to some you know, what you want to be career day at fifth grade or something, and you were supposed to dress like who you wanted to be. And I wore all black and a turtleneck like I was a beatnik. And I, from an early age, I became obsessed with Bob Dylan. I knew I wanted to come to New York City and Greenwich Village and NYU. So I was that kind of kid. I've just always been interested in kind of, I don't know, big ideas, old, and I'm very interested in religion. Even
clearly, clearly. This thinking didn't start with this book.
No.
That is a very true thing to say. It started a long time ago when you were a little kid, 8 years old, writing poems. You started thinking about relationships.
Yeah.
What words and space and time, and it shows up here. Read us another bit from the book.
Oh, sure. Patrick, well, I can just read from here.
Okay. All the beauty in the world. Well, was it hard finding a title?
Yeah, it was. Actually, we sold the book with a different title, but then that title wasn't so good. So,
what was it?
It was called The Day Watchman, like kind of different than The Night Watchman.
Yeah.
And this sort of watching is a motif, but this is a much better title. But yeah, I brainstormed a bunch of titles, and this was the one my editor thought was the best, and I've come
to
agree. See,
your time at the New Yorker wasn't wasted.
Yeah, oh yeah, yeah, exactly. But yeah, so this is a passage where you asked about looking at art, and there are many different ways to look at art, but this is one sort of method that I developed. So I write, in time, I develop a method for approaching a work of art. I resist the temptation to hunt right away for something singular about a work, the big deal that draws the focus of textbook writers. To look for distinctive characteristics is to ignore the greater part of what a work of art is. A portrait by Francisco de Goya is beautiful because of traits peculiar to his genius, but also because colors are beautiful, and shapes are beautiful, and faces are pretty, and curls tumble. In short, because attributes of our diverse and beguiling world have been recruited into a worthy medium. The first step in any encounter with art is to do nothing, to just watch, giving your eye a chance to absorb all that's there. We shouldn't think this is good, or this is bad, or this is a Baroque picture, which means X, Y, and Z. Ideally, for the first minute, we shouldn't think at all. Art needs time to perform its work on us.
Beautiful.
Oh, thank
you. Beautiful. It's nice having read this at night alone, and then hearing it come to life. What's your audiobook like?
Yeah, I got to read it, which was very fun. I sort of had to argue them into it, because I think just a little bit, because I think, you know, not every author will, you know, some of us are wooden and wouldn't necessarily do a great job reading it. Also, I think it cost them a little more. Because,
did you go to a studio?
Yes. So
in New York?
I went to a studio and...
How much did you do a day?
There's
how many?
A director and there's a producer. My director, we did about 5 hours a day. We had about 3 5-hour sessions to create the book. I think the book's like 7 hours or so. And it's...
Can we get it on Audible?
You can get it on Audible. Yep, anywhere you can get it. And the director gave me very good advice, which is... which I'm trying to use right now. She said, just speak to one person, you know, because it is a very intimate medium. So she said, in fact, there was a chair in the studio. She said, pretend that there's, you know, an old man sitting in that chair and you're just telling him the story. You don't have to be actorly. You don't have to be performative.
Very good advice.
Communicate. So I was happy to do it because, of course, I know what I want to communicate through the book.
Did you edit the book first?
Yeah.
Or is it word for word?
The audio is same as the book. Same as the book, yeah.
Every word.
Yeah, every word.
We can get it. We can listen to you as we jog.
Yeah. Exactly, as you do your dishes.
Yeah. So what is next for you? Because once you win something, for some reason, it gives you a lot of energy.
Okay, yeah,
to
maybe.
Go on. What are you writing next?
So I'm working on two things. One is I'm adapting the book into a one-man play, speaking of the Belle of Amherst. Because you can see there's a little bit of logic to it. You know, I'm a lonely man in an art gallery, so a lonely man on a stage has some sense to it. It's not 1,000% booked, so I can't tell you exactly what it's going to be. But in the fall, I'm going to be performing it out of town, and then hopefully I'll bring it to New York. We'll see.
You are performing a one-man show.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it will be a monologue, a stage monologue. Well, that is going to take just the stamina it took to be a guard.
Yeah, it'll be a lot of
fun. Because you have to go to the Whale every night.
Yes,
and I know you can do that. Yeah. And the book that you're writing.
Yes, so I'm also working on a book. I'm in the very early stages of imagining it, which is very fun. And it's going to take me a while to imagine it because I think, you know, to the extent that this book is any good, it's because I spent years thinking thoughts, and then I was able to sort of plagiarize those thoughts and put it in a book.
How many years in the making for all the beauty?
I mean, you know, the actual writing of it was 18 months and then 6 months of editing, but I had been thinking those thoughts on post for the whole 10 years, really, and making notes and things. And then the last couple of years, I was sort of seriously writing, trying to figure out what it could be, and I used that, you know, writing to get an agent, and then we put together a book proposal. So all of that was years in the making.
People need to know what it takes.
Yeah, so this new book, it's going to be about art again. It's going to be about the world and existence and the meaning of life.
The little stuff.
The little stuff. Because I do think that going, you know, what do we use art for? What do we use this big temple for? Some people go in there to learn about art history, and they're interested in learning what the Rococo was and who. But most people aren't, you know? Most people go in there because they want to experience beauty, and they want to have these sort of portals in thinking about life and
I think it's very important to teach people that not everything has utility.
Yeah.
And that is what art is and what thinking is and what love is. You know, there doesn't have to be a use for it. And I think that's an awfully important thing. Let us hear a final poem.
I know you're used to it.
Look at that.
I know.
My subconscious gave you the new moniker.
Well, this is actually a very good segue because this short passage is about exactly what I was just speaking about. I say, too many visitors think of the Met as a museum of art history, capital A, capital H, where the objective is to learn about art rather than from it. Too many suppose there are experts who know all the right answers, and it isn't a layman's place to dig into objects and extract what meaning they can. The more time I spend in the Met, the more convinced I am it isn't a museum of art history, not principally. Its interests reach up to the heavens and down into worm-ridden tombs and touch on virtually every aspect of how it feels and what it means to live in the space between. There aren't experts about that. I believe we take art seriously when we try to discern what, at close quarters, it reveals. I hope those kids will take their assignment seriously, and I think they've made a good start.
The voice of Patrick Bringley. He is the 18th recipient of the Marfield Award for Writing in the Arts from the D.C. Arts Club of Washington. And the program is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. The series is Forest Woods Media Production, post-production by Mike Turpin, MET Studios. We wish to thank the Library of Congress for making the program possible. Funding is provided by the Snippet Fund, the Rivada Foundation, the Anne Arundel Arts Council, and friends of The Poet and the Poem, Natalie Canavore, Sandra Jackson Cohen, and Avi Deshashani. Mike Turpin's our engineer, and I'm Grace Cavalieri.